The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The November issue of Our State Magazine features articles all about North Carolina's heroes among us, a salute to the military personnel who call our state home. There's a picture here on the menu of the Our State Magazine that is showing the U.S. Army Airborne and Special Operations Museum in Fayetteville, which follows more than 80 years of U.S. military service or history. The Iron Mike statue, and in honor of the airborne troopers, is shown in the foreground of the picture, with the museum itself behind. And the Iron Mike statue is surrounded by a platoon of flags, of American flags. First up is the welcome message for this month, entitled A Silent Salute. This is by the editor of the magazine, Elizabeth Hudson. In the taproom of Forgotten Road Ales in Greensboro, a wall of lush greenery artfully mounted behind the bar draws you in. The preserved moss, rich and velvety, and deep shades of forest and emerald. I'd been here a few dozen times before I realized that the subtle camouflage pattern it formed was no accident, but a tribute to co-founder and brewer Bryn Farrar's decade of service as a combat engineer in the U.S. Marine Corps, with deployments that took him to Iraq and Afghanistan. Farrar opened Forgotten Road Ales in Graham in 2019, then expanded with a second taproom in Greensboro in 2022. His military story is woven throughout the space, but not in loud proclamations. Aside from the chevron logo reflecting Farrar's rank of staff sergeant and the beers carrying names like Day Patrol and Gunny's Irish Stout, the military symbolism here is understated with no overwhelming display of ceremony. Unlike the industrial design of many breweries, Forgotten Road feels different, softer. The atmosphere is warm, more like a cozy coffee shop than a tap room. Well-tended houseplants rest on top of bookshelves filled with board games and cookbooks. Two caramel leather sofas face each other, inviting you to sit, relax, let down your guard. The hand-painted floor, the glow of bronze ceiling tiles, and even the walnut bar top, which Farrar sourced from the hardwood store in Gibsonville, gives the space a lived-in feeling. The name Forgotten Road speaks to the emotional journey that many veterans face when they return home, an unseen path where their sacrifices fade from view. The bar has opened Veterans Nights, but mostly this is a place where stories unfold intimately in the comfort of shared spaces. In a state that's home to more than a half million veterans, the military influence can often be loud, commanding attention. Visit Goldsboro during the Wings Over Wayne air show, and you'll hear jet engines, the sound of freedom, as the airmen say, roaring through the skies over Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. Attend the Veterans Day Parade in Fayetteville, and the 82nd Airborne Division All-American Band strikes up a sound that moves through you like a pulse. The blare of brass cutting through the air, the roll of a snare drum, powerful and proud. In Jacksonville, military convoys rumble steadily along UNC Highway 24, called Freedom Way, heading to and from Camp Lejeune. But just as often, that military influence is quiet, hidden in silent exchanges, a small emblem on a worn hat, a fading tattoo beneath a rolled-up shirt sleeve, a glance shared between those who've served, wordless but always understood. At the Beirut Memorial in Jacksonville, I saw this quiet reverence in action. A man approached the wall, the one bearing the phrase, "They came in peace," and rested his hand gently next to one of the names etched in stone. He lingered, and I wasn't going to disturb him, But then he turned, met my eyes, and with a gentle voice said, "I just stopped by to visit an old friend." In that brief moment, I understood the weight of the past he carried. In North Carolina, we find places for reflection, for shared experiences that need no grand gesture, for stories held in silence. In the unspoken moments, forgotten roads are remembered. And now I'll take you on a descriptive journey through this month's pictorial essay entitled The Sweet Spot, featuring North Carolina's deep history with sweet potatoes and some new uses of our state's beloved vegetable. On the cover, there's a picture of KS Farms in Johnston County, which grows about 360 acres of the North Carolina state vegetable, which is known as the sweet potato. And in this picture, we have the pickup truck with the bed facing toward us. It's got a license tag that says Sweet Tater, SWT-TATR. And that old cream, old-fashioned pickup truck is loaded down with orange sweet potatoes. And turning to the pictorial, which is called The Sweet Spot. North Carolina produces more sweet potatoes than any other state in the country, giving us cause to celebrate at our farms, around our tables, and in our communities. Developed by NC State University in 2005, the orange-fleshed Covington variety accounts for the majority of sweet potatoes grown in the state. And we have a couple of pictures here showing those that deep orange, almost a coral, orangey pinky color. And K&S Farms in Johnston County and Barnes Farming in Nash County are some of the big growers of that variety. On the next page, the caption is showing Barnes Farming in Spring Hope. A tractor pulling a digger uproots sweet potatoes at Barnes Farming, the world's largest sweet potato farm by acreage. And you have an interesting change of color on this picture. It's a two-page spread. On the right, there's a darker green and, you know, probably mixed with the dark, rich soil. And then you have the plants on the left side in all in nice and even rows. And but you can see where on the right it's been harvested and the soil turned over, and the potato. And then you have a picture of a tractor pulling through the rows with plants, and it's a nice juxtaposition. Moving forward in the essay, Born of the Earth, Scott Farms in Lucama. On a sixth-generation family farm in Lucama, owners Linwood, also known as Sonny, Scott Jr., and his wife Alice and their sons Linwood III and Dewey harvest more than 4,500 acres of sweet potatoes each year. Scott planted the first crop on the tuber on the farm, which had traditionally grown tobacco, after returning from a tour of duty in the Army Reserve. Today, the family both grows and packs the vegetables and distributes them both domestically and internationally. And we've got a couple of the three proud farmers carrying on that tradition, standing in their field of sweet potatoes. On the right side, we have in the background, we see some workers picking sweet potatoes up out of the ground. And in the foreground, we see a bucket of those sweet potatoes that have already been harvested. Sweet inspiration. Sweet potatoes, well, shut my mouth. Winston-Salem. Chef Stephanie Tyson wanted to name the sweet potato that she and Vivian Joyner opened in 2003 Sweet Potatoes because of the versatility of the vegetable, which often appeared on her menu. When a friend gave them a painting that said, sweet potato, shut my mouth, the two added the phrase to the official name. The venue in Winston-Salem's downtown arts district features sides like sweet potato biscuits with molasses, as well as sweet potato cornbread, staples that remind diners of food their mothers and grandmothers used to cook for them. Being able to have people come together and share what I do and what I have to give, Tyson says, is the best feeling ever. On the facing page, we have a picture of the two ladies, and they offer a sweet potato sangria to complement their sweet potato cornbread, which is served with hot honey ginger butter. And we also show a picture of the storefront of sweet potatoes. Well, shut my mouth, on downtown Winston-Salem. A Spud celebration. Now, this, of course, has already happened last weekend, but you still might can plan for it for next year. A Spud celebration, the North Carolina Yam Festival in Tabor City. Must be the last Saturday of October. When the first North Carolina Yam Festival was held in 1946 in Tabor City, the town was becoming known as the yam capital of the world. "We are well aware that what we grow here are sweet potatoes, not yams," explained Cynthia Nelson, manager of the North Carolina Yam Festival Association, but she feels that this way the name is just a little catchier. The annual celebration was revived in the mid-80s after a two-decade hiatus and has been held the fourth Saturday in October ever since. Attendees can visit food vendors for sweet potato treats like donuts and fries, enter their creative sweet potato dishes in a cook-off, or get a little messy with the hands-free sweet potato pie eating contest. Whatever folks participate in, they're bound to leave happy. For more information, check out ncyamfestival.com. The festival's parade in downtown Tabor City features marching bands, dancers, and Yam Man, the festival's mascot. A season for sharing. Sweet potato drop. This is in Belhaven, Bethel, and Robertsonville. Having grown up in poverty in New York, the Reverend Dr. Rodney Coles Sr. knows what it feels like to experience hunger. In 2004, he and his wife, Deborah, founded the church's outreach network to alleviate hunger and provide resources and education to those in need. To further that goal, the organization began a sweet potato drop of tubers donated from Greenville area farmers in 2012. Now, more than a decade later, the event will take place in Bethel, Belhaven, and Robertsonville on the Friday before Thanksgiving, when a total of 3 tractor trailers full of sweet potatoes are made available to the community for free. "There was a time when I was the cup," Cole says, "of being in need as a child, but I feel so good now to be the pitcher." Community members come together to volunteer at the sweet potato drop in Robertsonville. And we have a picture here of several people: Chief Deputy Drew Robertson, Mayor Tina Brown, the Reverend Dr. Rodney Cole Sr., Pastors Angel and Ronnie Staten, and Velva Brown. And it looks like there's different varieties of sweet potatoes here. And there's on the facing page, there's a big dump truck that has unloaded his stash of sweet potatoes onto the ground, and it's a huge pile. For the biscuit, Bellcross Biscuit Company in Camden. Jeff Burns grew up in Texas watching his grandmother make biscuits in the mornings. He'd never had a sweet potato biscuit until he moved to North Carolina around age 15, and even then, the slightly sweet, flaky treats had to grow on him. "I enjoy them thoroughly now," he says. Today, Burns, owner of Bellcross Biscuit Company since 2022, starts off by roasting sweet, fresh potatoes and finishes by baking the biscuits until they're golden brown on the bottom. "While they're baking," he says, "you smell caramelized butter and sweet potato, and you know you're in the right place." Sweet potato biscuits are kind of a North Carolina thing, Jeff Burns says. He especially likes the crispy ones from the edge of the pan, and his favorite way to eat them is plain with a cup of coffee. And we have a picture of his bake shop and a picture of him. And on the facing page, we have a whole page picture of 3 stacked orange biscuits that look very tasty and moist and flaky at the same time. Next up is the Farm Spirit, Ham Farms in Snow Hill. After growing up on a tobacco farm, Bobby Ham planted his first Covington sweet potatoes in his native Greene County in the early 1980s and now grows about 9,000 acres of the crop. Ham Farms offers whole sweet potatoes, purees, and a sweet potato vodka. Spirits aside, the sweet potato is one of the healthiest foods there is on the planet, Ham says, and he adds, North Carolina's an ideal place to grow it. Covington vodka is made from sweet potato puree and is one of the many products developed by the Ham Farms team. And that team is listed there, mostly your family members, shown there on that picture. And we have a picture of the Covington sweet potato vodka. It actually has a picture on the label of a sweet potato and its associated plant. Interesting. Fall favorite, Full Steam Brewery in Durham. The Carver sweet potato lager poured at Full Steam Brewery isn't loaded down with a bunch of the spices that people typically associate with sweet potatoes. The early genius of Carver came from our first head brewer, who is Chris Davis, who said that he wanted the subtle earthy flavor of sweet potato to take center stage, says Sean Lilly Wilson, who founded the brewery in 2010. The amber lager is served seasonally in the fall, and dedicated customers look forward to its release every year. Full Steam Brewery owner Sam Lilly Wilson named the Carver sweet potato lager for agricultural scientist and inventor George Washington Carver, who promoted the planting of sweet potatoes in soils depleted by cotton. And we have a picture, this two-page spread shows a picture of the can of sweet potato harvest lager, Carver. And we show the owner sitting enjoying one of his lagers and looking down over the restaurant area. And there must be a sort of a plaza in the middle where folks can sit and hang out. Last Bite. Beloved Chapel Hill restaurateur and cookbook author Mildred, also known as Mama Dip, Council made her sweet potato pie with fresh sweet potatoes, boiled and hand-mashed. Although Council died in 2018, the pie with its custardy filling continues to be a family favorite, especially at Thanksgiving. And we have a picture of the pie in an old pie tin. Switching gears here, we're going to move to the hidden history section, and the article is entitled Pressed into Service. Just prior to the Great Depression, a Gaston County textile mill introduced a special khaki weave that served our armed forces with distinction for five decades. In 1966, after 8 years in the Navy, Rhett Cozart was promoted to Chief Petty Officer, even though he was stationed in Key West, Florida, where he served as an instructor at Fleet Sonar School. Donning that new khaki uniform magically transported him 900 miles home to Cramerton, the small mill town where the material for his uniform was first woven and is where his father still worked. You could tell they were good quality, Cozart says. They had a tight weave, but they still breathed and held their shape. In all, three of the Cozart brothers had careers in the Navy, along with two uncles, and each of them had the opportunity to wear the 8.2-ounce Army khaki that was developed in 1929 and used by all branches of the U.S. military. So how did a small cotton textile mill in rural North Carolina develop a khaki twill that was worn by millions of American soldiers in multiple branches of service across three wars? To answer that question, it's first worth exploring the life of Stuart Cramer, one of the most extraordinary industrialists and inventors that North Carolina has ever produced. Never heard of him? The next time you flip a switch on a light or turn the AC to high on a sweltering day, you might want to whisper a word of thanks to this gentleman. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Born in Thomasville in 1868, Cramer attended the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis and studied mining engineering at Columbia University School of Mines. Afterward, he became a chief assayer, testing the purity of precious metals for the U.S. Mint in Charlotte. People were still finding gold in the area, says his grandson, R. Warren Cramer. They would bring in their gold and have it assayed. But he was so fresh-faced and young, people kept asking to see the man in charge. He proceeded to grow a wonderful mustache. That helped to give him some gravitas. Before long, Kramer found his true calling, designing and building textile mills. In the span of 15 years, he either built or designed more than 150 mills and published a 4-volume handbook on the subject. During that period, he also found time to obtain 60 patents, working with James Buck Duke to create North Carolina's first electric power company, operate Kramer chair manufacturing, and develop the earliest version of air conditioning to control humidity and improve air quality in the mills. He even coined the term air conditioning. But by 1915, Kramer was at the end of his tether. His health began to break, Warren says. According to his grandson, Kramer was getting on by on 5 hours of sleep a night and eating poorly on the long train rides to his multiple mill projects. When his wife told him the stress was killing him, he decided she was right. Although Kramer had become a shareholder with many of the companies that he'd worked with, he'd never owned a mill outright. But that was about to change. One of the mills he liked was in the community of Mayworth, about 15 miles from his home in Charlotte. He bought out the owner and divested himself of his other businesses. It was already a very fine mill community, Moran says, but he wanted to make it the best in the world. Having seen firsthand a wide variety of mill operations, Kramer had insight into what made a mill successful, and he couldn't help but notice that happy, healthy, and content workers were more productive. The engineer reimagined the mill in the town, ultimately giving both the name Kramerton. For his employees, Kramer designed homes that were models of modernity, with electricity, hot water, and good ventilation. He paved the streets and installed sewers and streetlights. He built churches and schools. He attracted the best teachers and promoted education, encouraging the children of his workers to set their sights on a future beyond the mill. He also built a community center with ample recreational opportunities. We practically lived at the gymnasium and swimming pool, Cozart remembers. It was probably the best family-oriented company that you'd ever want to run across. Alice Brown agrees. It was a wonderful place to grow up, says a third-generation mill worker. We had everything we needed. We didn't have to leave Kramerton for anything. Brown also has fond memories of Kramer's wife, Rebecca. She was the sweetest woman, I'll tell you. She would load up her car with fresh fruit and come down to Center Street and give it away to everybody. She just loved Kramerton. Kramer recruited Brown's grandfather, Edward Reese, to run the plant. See, my grandpa grew up in Thomasville, and Mr. Kramer grew up in Thomasville, Brown says. So they met, and Mr. Kramer really liked my grandpa. He said, Mr. Ed, I bought the maize plant in a little town, and I want you to go with me. Kramer's winning personality and knack for developing relationships served him beyond hiring plant managers. He worked with the likes of Westinghouse and Edison and served as an economic advisor to Presidents Coolidge and Hoover. Ultimately, it was his relationship with his former Annapolis roommate, Curtis Wilbur, who'd gone on to become Secretary of the Navy, that led to the creation of Kramerton Khaki. According to Warren, the two men were reminiscing about their time at the U.S. Naval Academy, lamenting the heavy wool uniforms they used to wear. Though decades had passed, Wilbur pointed out, there had not been much improvement in the uniforms. Well, Kramer replied, I'm in the cotton textile business now. And just like that, an idea was born. Kramer returned to the plant and solicited advice from his two sons, Stuart Jr. and George Bennett, who were both working for him. Stuart Jr. had served on General John Pershing's staff as a West Point officer. George Bennett, Warren's father, would go on to serve with distinction as a liaison to the White House and was later recommended by President Roosevelt to Winston Churchill as an American liaison between the British and American Air Forces. He talked it over with Stuart Jr. and Dad, and they all said, "We all need lightweight uniforms," Warren says. Stuart Jr. had connections with the Quartermaster Depot in Philadelphia, and a set of requirements were drawn up for summer weight uniform. Stuart Jr. stewarded the development at Kramerton Mills. They used a strong, long fiber that was woven into a tight cotton twill that felt almost like silk. It made for a wrinkle-resistant, almost waterproof fabric. Warren says, the military said, this is some good stuff. The Navy used it for a while, then the Army requested it. First manufactured in 1929, it became known as Cramerton Army Cloth. The timing of its development couldn't have been better. Production of the new fabric helped the plant survive the Great Depression. And thanks to the peacetime 30s, Cramerton Mills could produce all the khaki the military needed until the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. Suddenly, demand for khaki far outstripped Cramerton Mills' ability to produce it. More than three generations of Cramers had already served in the military, so the value of service had long been threaded into the strands of their DNA. Having by then taken over management of the mill, the two sons released the patent, allowing other manufacturers to make the famous twill. This act of selflessness likely deprived the company of millions in future profits while earning something far more valuable, the enduring gratitude of a nation at war. In 1942, Cramerton Mills was bestowed the coveted Army-Navy E Award for achievement in the production of war materials. After World War II, former soldiers using their GI Bill benefits flooded college campuses, and they repurposed their uniform khaki pants for peacetime use, creating a casual style that showed no sign of wearing out. George Bennett handed down his old Army Air Corps duds to his son Warren, who wore them through his days at Duke University. Those shirts had body and firmness and structure that kept them sharp even though they were 30 to 40 years old, Warren marvels, even through those hot Duke summers. Stuart Jr. and George Bennett sold Cramerton Mills to Burlington Industries in 1946. By 1978, both of the original Cramerton Mill plants had closed and the town of Cramerton struggled. It's certainly good to see that Cramerton has hung on, and there were periods where it was going through hard times, says Cozart, who should know. He returned to his hometown after retiring from the Navy, serving 12 years on the town council and 4 as mayor. Thanks to dedicated public servants like Cozart, Cramerton has experienced a steady renaissance. Instead of being torn down, hundreds of mill houses have been renovated. Kids still flock to the pool and gym built by the Cramers. Every Sunday, the churches he designed draw faithful congregants. As a matter of fact, you don't have to spend much time with the residents of Cramerton to realize that the qualities they embody, durability, resilience, and steadfastness, are the same ones woven into the fabric that made their town famous. Well, that sound indicates that we're out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. And so long until next time.